You're listening to episode 25 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang. Woohoo! Happy 25th episode, you guys!
Am I doing this right?
Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Woo! That was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey guys, before we get into today's interview, I'd love to thank Scrivener for sponsoring today's episode. I fell head over heels in love with the writing software ever since I learned about how Scrivener helped my recent guest on the show, award-winning writer Jan Ellison, with her debut novel, A Small Indiscretion. You can check it out for yourself and try Scrivener for free for 30 days. If you end up loving it as much as I do, Scrivener hooked us up with a special 20% off coupon code just for our storyteller tribe, and we have until the end of December 2015 before it expires. Head over to 88cupsofteat.com/Scrivener for the coupon code. Hey storytellers, hello again from Malaysia. I'm just a few hours away from catching a flight to Singapore. We have part two of Dan Santat's interview today. If you haven't had the chance to listen to part one from the previous episode, I urge you to check it out because I would really love for you to get an idea of how his creative mind works through examples of his creation process of Caldecott Medal winning book, The Adventures of Beagle, The Unimaginary Friend. I'm so excited about today's part two episode with Dan because you really get an idea of the values that guides Dan's choices with his career, family, and life overall. He's an incredible example of what it means to be an artist, a storyteller, and a human being. Aside from a ton of actionable advice he generously shares, we dive pretty deep into Dan's personal life and what drives him to be the father and husband that his family can always count on, all while managing and balancing a wildly successful career as an illustrator and author. Last week, we ended part one of Dan's episode with a glimpse of his thoughts about networking, and in today's episode, we'll continue right around where we left off. Dan is going to take us through examples of how social media like Facebook allows him to network, stay current and connected, and attract interest from social networks like editors in a genuine and authentic way. This is a super special interview I saved to celebrate my 25th episode on 88 Cups of Tea, so please soak in every word Dan says and take them to heart. Now let's jump right in.
I want to know what your take is on the whole networking situation. How do you think that applies to being a children's book author and or illustrator, if it does at all?
For me, I think it's been invaluable. In particular, when I was starting out, my first order of business was I wanted every art director and editor to know who I was, because I wanted that opportunity to be that person that's in their mind to be considered for, you know, an illustration job. What I did was I would meet a lot of people at conferences, or I would go out to New York and I would meet people at like award banquets and things like that, book expos, and you get to know them. My first thing is I would gather names from people in the publishing, and I remember I would friend them on Facebook. And for me, like, I knew that my value, my strongest asset, was illustration. Traditionally, what happens is that illustrators send out postcards, you know, and then they mail it out to the publisher, and the publisher looks at the postcards and says, I will consider this person for illustration work. And I took the angle of friending editors and art directors on Facebook, and rather than soliciting them and saying, I would like you to work for me, I would just show an illustration that I was working on. Mm. And I'm not selling my work to a person. I'm sharing it with a friend. You know what I'm...
When you say sharing, you mean posting it on your wall for everyone to see rather than actual private messaging them, right?
Right.
Okay, gotcha.
And the thing about Facebook is that there's a lot of power in having a visual post. You know, like if you write a one word, I guess, what do you want to say, a post on Facebook, that's a one line sentence that can get drowned out by these bigger links, or, you know, like if you post an image, the human eye naturally just wants to stop and look at things. And so if I'm posting an illustration, everyone's going to look at it. I'm not soliciting. I'm saying, hey, you agreed to be my friend, and here, let's see what I'm working on. And I remember one time saying, I'd really like to do a book about firemen. And I remember I just did a fireman portfolio piece, and I put it out there, And like a week later, I got a manuscript for a book about firemen.
Wow. And that was through Facebook.
Yeah. That was through
freaking
Facebook.
Freaking awesome.
And so with different social media, I approach it different ways. So with Facebook, you know, there's a lot of editors and art directors, and I never sullen the relationship by just making it about work. I kind of take the approach of, like, I don't even want to say a used car salesman, but like, if you go to a car dealership, they always try to make this connection with you. Like, oh, what's your name? Oh, my name's Lisa. And it's like, oh, Lisa. Well, my niece is named Lisa. Isn't that funny? We should be friends. And you want to buy a used car. You want to buy this car from your friend who has a niece named Lisa. That's what we have in common, right? Yeah, because we're buddies. You know, that's kind of that thing of, like, tearing down the walls, and you're no longer buying a car from a stranger. You're buying a car from a friend. And so I see a lot of people putting up, you know, professional author pages and stuff like that, and not wanting to reveal parts of their personal life, which, you know, it's your prerogative. That's perfectly fine. For me, if I'm playing Legos with my kids, then sure, I will post an image of something I built with Legos with my kids. Or my kids and I have this game where they'll draw something, and then I draw my version of it. So there's a good balance between personal life and professional life that I throw in there so that my persona is not just about work, because that can get really annoying. Like, oh, this guy's just going to keep soliciting me every second. You know, it's, oh, look, he made those cookies. Those look amazing. And I've had relationships with, like, really well-known authors. Like, I'm a good friend with the editorial director at HarperCollins. We've never worked together, but we're friends because we have cooking in common. And, you know, she'll write to me and talk about, you know, recipes that she's working on, or, you know, she'll give me a recommendation for a restaurant if I'm someplace on a book tour. But there's also some great value in that relationship, even though you're not working with that editor in particular. Because if one editor knows who you are, then word gets around and everyone says, oh, did you see what Dan Santat said on Facebook? Or did you see, you know, that illustration that he did? You know, I know you haven't worked with him before, but I know you're looking for a manuscript that needs a penguin, and he posted a great illustration of a penguin. You know, the idea of social media is most effective if not only sharing it with the audience that you want to buy your book, but also the potential people who can employ you for a certain job. But it really comes down to being nice to everybody that you're friends with and being sincerely, like a sincerely good friend, you know? And
yeah.
Because there's something about that. There's that non-threatening feeling of, you know, like, this person never asks me for work because, you know, he's just a nice guy. And since Facebook, since Twitter, I haven't had to advertise traditionally with, like, postcards or anything for, like, the last 7-8 years. And now I'm at a position in my career where I don't have to solicit myself to editors and art directors, because I'm at that point now. I'm at that point where I no longer have to say, hey, hire me, you know? I've got to that point where people know who I am, and they say, Dan Santat would be right for the job. Now, and I find this is more helpful with Twitter. And for the longest time, I've tried figuring out, what is Twitter good for? And really, it just comes down to in-the-moment dialogues. And that's it. But there was also a great amount of librarians and teachers who do more tweeting than they actually do Facebook.
Really?
And
I feel like Twitter is so, like, I feel like they market it to the much younger generations, like younger than my little sisters. I'm still trying to figure out Twitter.
Right. And even for, like, the younger generation, I think they've moved on to Snapchat.
I cannot keep up.
Right. I don't think Twitter is the kind of thing for, I'd say, anybody over 25. But for someone like myself, there are librarians. There are teachers, there are educators, there are independent bookstores, there are book buyers, there are publishers, there are, oh gosh, classrooms. Like, some teachers will have classrooms. Like, oh, Mrs. Gilbert's third grade class is showing off the art project that we did for this book that we read, you know? So like, for example, there was a time, like, after Beagle won the Caldecott, someone had made, because the East Coast had that horrible snowstorm for the entire winter.
Mm.
And people were so excited about Beagle winning that they were making snow beagles. They were making snowmen beagle shaped, you know, and they'd put crowns on them, and then they'd give it, like, two coal eyes and a smile. And then you retweet that, and then you find that, you know, someone else in another state would do it, and then another. And like that suddenly started turning into a thing where classrooms and teachers started doing snow beagles, you know, all over these different states.
That is so freaking cute.
And then like, you know, sometimes like I said, like those Twitter accounts for classes, they'd say, oh, well, you know, we just read Beagle by Dan Santat, who we happen to friend at D Santat. And we just wanted to show you the imaginary friend project that we did, where all the kids afterwards drew their own imaginary friends. And, you know, just writing a quick tweet back saying, like, that looks spectacular. Thanks for sharing. Like, that means the world to them. Because, like, it's like, I'm out in Maryland. There's nothing to do out here, you know? You're an author and you shared your interest in what we're doing. That is huge to a room of third graders. And then this is the crazy thing about librarians, is that there are some librarians who are like rock and roll superstar librarians, where all the librarians look at those librarians and they say, what is the in thing right now? Like, what do you like, you know? And to like build relationships with those librarians and to have them say, yeah, guys, whales are really cool right now. And this is the best whale book this year. Like that can send ripples across the country if you do it right. Because some of those librarians, they influence so many people. And what a lot of people don't realize is that a lot of these publishing houses, Random House, HarperCollins, Penguin, sometimes they will roll out the red carpet and they will fly these librarians in to like, they'll have like a seasonal list preview. They'll say, these are our list of books for the fall. What do you think? These librarians are so powerful with the social media that they'd say, I just saw this new book from Dan Santat. It looks amazing. I can't wait for it to come out in stores. You should check it out when it comes out. There are some librarians that they hold a tremendous amount of power. You know, rather than you being the one voice saying, hey, everybody, buy my book. You friend a lot of librarians out in the country, then suddenly you have thousands of spokespeople that say, you guys should buy Dan Santat books. You know, that's mm-hmm. the value that I found in Twitter, is that you make yourself available to people who might have questions or might want to share things, and you're open and inviting to it. And you say, well, thank you. You know, really what the majority of people want is just for your acknowledgement, you know? Like how many times have I tweeted to Kanye West hoping that he would tell me to go jump off a bridge, you know? How many times have I tweeted to Neil deGrasse Tyson saying, like, say something nerdy to me. I want your love, you know? I remember I had a friend, he tweeted to Alec Baldwin, and Alec Baldwin, like, called him a douchebag. And we were all just like, he called you a douchebag. That's so awesome. it's those kind of things, yeah.
That's amazing. I love that. And do you use Instagram for anything?
Gosh, you know, like maybe 7 years ago when blogging was a huge thing.
Right.
Rather than blogging, I have a Tumblr page. And so it's basically like snapshots of my life. Hey, look, guys, I'm on tour here in Knoxville, Tennessee. Oh, hey, guys, I'm signing stock here at Vroman's Books in Pasadena. If you want a signed copy, go to Vroman's Books. You know, so with the Tumblr page, because I have the Instagram app, and the beauty of the Instagram app is that I can post it once on Instagram, and then it'll send it out to Twitter, it'll send it out to Facebook, and it'll send it out to Tumblr. So I can cover four bases just with one posting. Instagram's really fascinating because I remember I hustled to get 2,000 followers. And then I have a niece who's 13 years old, and she'll snap like a selfie of herself with like an ice cream cone. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh my God, 1,000 likes. And I'm like, what is going on in this crazy world of teenagers? Like, oh, I like salad too. And I'm like, I just busted my ass doing this illustration and I'm lucky to get 30 or 40 likes. But, you know, it's like, oh, you're so pretty with your hair that way, you know? And that's the other thing, is that I do find that there's a lot of people who misinterpret their social media fan base as potential buyers. Mm. One does not mean the other. There are people that just do really great illustrations, but then when a book comes out, it just falls flat and they don't understand why. It's interesting to see how this whole internet celebrity thing's going to pan out years from now. Like, is it going to be a thing where, oh, okay, I saw your channel of you talking about playing Minecraft for an hour a day, and I get it. You like Minecraft, you know? But yeah, no, I mean, I feel like that generation, like that whole trend just – completely, I missed the boat. I'm like 10 years too old to participate in that. And now we're just communicating on a whole different level. It's almost frustrating, you know? You're like, you look at some of these pages and you realize that this kid has 500,000 followers, but all they're doing is talking about what they did that day. And it's like, they're making stupid faces and fart sounds. And I'm like, please don't let this be the future of entertainment. Please don't. If I'm competing against this and I'm losing, like, then mankind is done for, because we might as well just turn the Jimmy Fallon show into that. Just stand in front of the camera, make fart sounds and goofy faces and talk about what you ate today.
Oh, so frustrating.
So social media, I reach out to a different audience. I don't reach out to the consumer. I'm not telling, hey, consumers, go buy my book. I'm reaching out to those who can share my works with a greater audience.
Got it. I think that's really smart. Mm-hmm. Dan, I wanted to ask a little bit about the Caldecott Medal.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's so many children's books out there each year that are being published.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work?
Yeah. So the Caldecott Committee is 15 librarians who are elected into those positions. And they represent the ALA, the American Library Association. And so their process is actually very secret. It's public knowledge on who the judges are for that particular year. And with that, there are stipulations that they're not allowed to talk about it at all. They're really told to keep social media to a minimum. And the thing about being a Caldecott judge is that you will probably be solicited books by publishers like, hey, you should check out this book. But a publisher is very mindful of not pushing it too much, because if you're trying to force a book down a Caldecott judge's throat, they will turn on you like that. Because if there's anything a Caldecott judge does not like, it's to be told what they should like.
Yeah.
Because they take that responsibility very importantly. And to my understanding, they meet 2 or 3 times a year. And any book that is published by a major publisher is fair game. So it doesn't necessarily correlate to book sales. It doesn't correlate to what's popular. Traditionally, what they say is that the Caldecott Medal goes to the best illustrated book of that particular year. But because of what we were saying earlier about how picture books have to be half text, half illustration, and they both have to share the storytelling equally, a lot of the text gets wrapped up into what's considered the best illustrated book. Because there have been some great books that I've seen where, you know, like the illustrations are amazing and they're things that you've never seen before, but it just might not be a well-written book. And that's something that, you know, a book doesn't qualify for the Caldecott Medal. Like, when you have the Caldecott sticker on that, you're basically deeming it a classic, you know?
Yeah.
From now on, every library in this country will have this book. And, you know, they want to make sure, basically, that it's the equivalent to the best movie of the year in the Oscars. And so, to my understanding, I only know this because I've spoken to previous Caldecott judges, is that there's the ALA Midwinter Conference, which is held, you know, different parts of the country every year, typically takes place in January. And they take all the books from that calendar year, from like the previous year, and they will bring in their top 7 favorite books. And from those top 7, they go through a voting process. And this is all like within, you know, a few meetings, 2 or 3 meetings. So they break down their top 7 and then they have to rank them. This is my first, this is my second, this is my third place book, you know, and then of those 15 judges, 8 of those judges, so more than half of those judges have to deem the Caldecott Medal book the first place book.
Mm-hmm.
And they debate, they talk. Sometimes one person might have a book that they thought was first place and they have to convince other people, like, this should be your first place book. And maybe on another librarian's list, it was, you know, the third place book, or maybe they didn't consider it. And so there's a lot of back and forth. There's a lot of talk about, like, if you have a librarian who's very influential and can champion a book and push that book to a point where they could convince everyone in the room, this should be our winner, like, that might just be the case. But it has very little to do with sales. If you look through the history of books that have won the Caldecott Medal, traditionally, like, a lot of those books are never books that end up on the New York Times bestseller list until after they win the Caldecott Medal. Like, if you were to look at Drew Daywalt's book, The Day the Crayons Quit, I mean, that book has been number 1, number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list for, I think it's going on like 2 years now. two years now. It didn't win a Caldecott medal, but it's been the best-selling book. And in that in itself is a really great accolade. But if you were to take a book like Smoky Night or Brian Floca's book that won the Caldecott medal last year, Locomotive, those were not best-selling books. But once they got recognized by the Caldecott committee as their Caldecott medalist, then it got on the New York Times bestseller list. And it really is about... It really is about the quality of the book and the, I don't want to say agenda. I don't think agenda is the right word, but you know, every year you do notice things about each committee that stands out. So like, for example, last year, and this could purely be coincidence. I don't know, but if there's anything, book reviewers and librarians really do like to take the time to read between the lines. And so last year, I believe, I think three picture books were wordless picture books. And everyone just thought, whoa, like, is this the year of the wordless picture book? And this year, for instance, there's been the whole We Need Diverse Books campaign where they're talking about, well, we need books that represent people of different cultures. And you notice across the board, this year's Newbery winner, Kwame Alexander, is African American. You know, I am an Asian American. There were six honor books this year. Of those six Caldecott honor books, five of them were women. And that was something that was, you know, that people were saying, well, there should be more women that are represented in the awards panel. Again, I don't think it's an agenda, but I do keep my ear low to the ground to what people say about particular awards. And, you know, people always like to think that there is an agenda, and I don't think there is. There was a brief moment in winning this Caldecott medal where I was thinking to myself, because I do have like this issue of self-esteem where I think like, gosh, I don't know why I got this award, you know? And, and there was a brief period, there was a brief, like just an instant where I thought to myself, did I win this award because I'm Asian? Like, was I filling a quota? But it was for a brief moment. My agent slapped my hand and she said, "Yeah, like, knock it off. Enjoy this. Like, enjoy this."
I'm glad for your agent.
Yeah, just enjoy this. Like, forget. And everybody else, basically, like, you know, like, your book was great. You deserve it. And, you know, I think a lot of that anxiety, a lot of that self-doubt comes from reading reviews. And I'm notorious for reading reviews. I read everything from like 5-star, like, oh, I love this book, to like the 1-star from Anonymous. And of course, anybody who is creative and reads reviews, like, you can get showered with thousands of positive reviews. But the ones that stick in your mind are like the negative, like the one negative review. And you're like, why? Yeah. Why did you do that to me? And then you go into their Goodreads profile and it's like, oh, because you just like Naruto comics. Like, I'm not crazy. You're crazy, you know? I mean, just going into like why I read all the reviews is because as a writer, you know, sometimes I think that there's some value in reading some constructive criticism. And
right.
I'm a glutton for punishment. But in terms of the Caldecott Committee, no one really knows the secrets behind that coveted society that gets to grant you the award of immortality. But there is speculation from people who have been judges previously. And ultimately, I understand that, and this is another thing that I was struggling with, but ultimately, I understand that this is an award that you cannot wholeheartedly earn, meaning... And I was talking to a friend about this. Really, the best thing you can do is make a book that's good enough to be on that table of those 7 books. That's the best you can do. But deciding who gets the gold sticker is completely out of your hands. Like, that's been in my mind for months, you know, trying to come to terms with the fact that no matter how hard I work, I could never work so hard as to get that sticker, like to work it on, you know, like it really is, the Caldecott medal really is this, it's this gift that is bestowed upon you that you feel like you have to spend the rest of your life living up to. I think that's the best way to describe it.
Yeah.
So
it was interesting how you reacted to the initial awarding. At the end of the day, talent is talent, and I'm glad your agent slapped you in the hand.
Yeah, she's been great through this whole thing.
Yeah, that is so awesome you have her. And I'm just going to wrap it up with three final questions. So one of them, for those who are more beginner storytellers, specifically children's book authors and or illustrators, how would you advise our listeners to make a living while creating their art? Because that's a tough one.
It is a tough one. Well, I've met illustrators who only want to illustrate their own material. And that's their prerogative. If you want to be someone who works in children's publishing, I think it is worth your while to be open to illustrating other people's manuscripts, because you can learn a lot from other people's writings. There's Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hour rule of you get really good at something if you do it, you know, for 10,000 hours. And I just find that it not only pays the bills, but while you're paying the bills, you get the opportunity to experiment and express yourself and figure out things that you like to do, things that work, things that don't work in your body of work. Really, if you're starting out, don't be a snob about what you get. Everything, I think there's value in every job you get, you know, be it writing an article for doing a blog post, writing a $200 article for LA Weekly or something like that. I think there's value in everything that you write and you learn something from it. To make a living in children's books, it's honestly very tough. And I remember my art teacher saying, you know, struggle with it, you know, like 5 years, just focus on books or whatever, you know, gallery work or editorial work or whatever it is. But, you know, in 5 years, you're going to find yourself immersed in the middle of it. It's just putting in the mileage, putting in the time. I wasn't the kind of guy who liked to struggle and just sit and eat ramen for days on end. So I took the different approach of getting a 9-to-5 job and then spending my evenings working on my craft. So when I came out of art school, the first job I got was working in the video game industry, which I didn't hate it, but I didn't love it by any means, because they work you like a slave. But there is a comfort in getting a paycheck that I think helps your writing. And what I mean by that is, if you're a starving artist and you're writing, sometimes the starving part gets in. And that is you looking at your work and saying, can I sell this? I think that's the worst thing you can do for your material. I think if you are trying to find a dollar value in the work that you write, then your work is not being honest and it's not being the best quality work that you can do. I think you're being insincere with yourself and your ability and your voice if you're trying to fit into a particular class. Like, this sells, so I have to write this way, you know? The head of the grad program at the School of Visual Arts in New York, he said, do the work you love and the work will find you. I've always sworn to that. And I've also found that that is completely true. The thing you want to do is the thing that you do best. And so do what you do best and the work will find you. I mean, social media, like I said, people will find people who have common interests. If you have to get a 9-to-5 job, just know that that job doesn't define you as a person. You know, it's a means to an end. But, you know, there is the value in reaching out and communicating with the community of people who also have the same interests. Mm-hmm. And I hate to say it, but I think there's also a value in the people you are in a circle with. I don't want you to misinterpret as, you know, like being clicky, like, you know, like, oh, I should hang out with these people because they know these people. Don't look at your friends as a means to an end. Look at your friends as people who are willing to go through the struggle with you, but at the same time, you can value their opinion to maybe the critiques of your work, you know? Like I said, when you go to art school, the talented ones are the ones that push you and make you a better writer. If you're surrounded by talent, that can only help you, but it comes with patience. I like to say setting small goals for yourself. This year I want to get an agent. This year I want to get a manuscript sold. This year I want to write a graphic novel. This year I want to illustrate two books. I remember when I started out, I said, I want every editor in the business, every art director in the business to know who I am. I want to be able to make enough money this year that I don't have to have a video game job. One of the biggest perks these days in publishing is if they go out of their way to make a poster or, you know, put you on tour or something like that. And, you know, say, well, I hope that this book invites me to a conference. I hope they put me on a book tour with this author. I hope this book reaches a particular number of sales. It's constantly setting small goals for yourself that are attainable, you know? Don't say the first book out, like, I want this to win the Callicott Medal. Like, that's never going to happen. And for me, you know, here, this is my 10th, 11th year in publishing. And, you know, talking to one of my friends, I said, well, what is the biggest thing? She was a previous Callicott Medal winner. And I said, well, what is the biggest thing that you achieved from winning the Callicott Medal? And she said, it opened a lot of doors for me, new opportunities. But then she also made the point of saying, you've already opened those doors by setting small goals for yourself. So by winning this Callicott Medal, you're not really opening anything new. Like, you got there on your own without having to win this major award, you know? And that was just me with the discipline of setting goals for yourself. I mean, yes, getting this book, you know, on the New York Times bestseller list and getting it recognized by everybody else, it was a great accolade. I'm honored. I'm flattered. I'm very pleased that I won the Callicott Medal. But it wasn't something that I needed to sustain my career and take care of my family, you know, pay for my kids' school, pay for the mortgage and everything, you know? Yeah. Part of my career goals was to be able to be financially stable in a freelancing world, you know? If you're a freelancer and you can say, you know what, I'm pretty sure next year and the year after that, I will be financially covered because I know I'll get enough work. Like, that is the ultimate goal for a freelance artist. That feeling of not having to worry that this is going to be the last job that you ever get in your life. Yeah. Like, that's the best feeling in the world. Like, not having that anxiety. And I like to go back because when I worked at the video game company, when I worked at Activision, they always dangled your job over your head. They said, if you don't do this, we can always find someone else that can and they'll do it for less. You constantly had this worry over your head. Like, I'm going to get fired. I'm going to get fired if I don't do this. I'm going to get fired. And then you get to a point where you say, you know what? I don't care. I don't care if I get fired. It wasn't until I left the game company and I worked at freelancing where I actually felt more secure with my employment. Meaning, at the time, I was probably making just as much at the game company as I was freelancing. So I didn't really need the job. But just having that luxury of knowing that I could live and die by my own sword. Like, if I work harder, I can get more work. If I don't work, then I don't get work. But by not having somebody looming over your shoulder every day and saying, if you don't do this, we'll find someone better. You're replaceable. That horrible feeling of someone always saying that you can be replaced. Having that go away, I've never felt more job security in my life than when I finally went full-time freelance. It's a weird feeling, but kind of pushing away that negativeness of you're just another cog in the machine. Going freelance was the best feeling I ever did in my life, just knowing that I controlled my own destiny.
That is really cool. That's a lot of tips and advice in there for sure.
Sure.
And I know you mentioned family. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, how did you juggle time with your wife, your kids, and your career?
So I am a have your cake and eat it too kind of guy.
Awesome.
So I don't let up on work and I don't let up on family. But because of that, there's a considerable amount of, I guess I could say, wear and tear on myself. For like the last 10 years, I was probably existing on an average of maybe 4.5-5 hours of sleep a day. And, you know, if you sign a contract to do a book and it's due at a particular date, you have to hit that date. You can't miss it. But at the same time, I don't want to be that guy who is just like, I have kids and I have them sitting in front of a TV all day, you know? I have kids, I have a responsibility to them, and I'm going to make sure that they get the most out of everything. So typically what happens is, like, the kids go to school. I'm Mr. Mom. My wife works at Caltech. She does cell research.
Wow.
But I guess the demands of that job, she's a perfectionist, so she stresses out about a lot of things. Everything has to be perfect. So I'm kind of like, I'm the anchor. Like, I'm the guy that has to keep everything in check. Like, I'm the one that takes the kids to school. I make their lunches.
Aww, you know. That's so cute.
I make them breakfast, take them to school, I pick them up, I take them to soccer practice, take them to piano lessons, I do the laundry, I do the dishes, I get dinner ready.
That's so awesome.
Like, I am Mr. Mom. I have to do that. The best way to do it is to compartmentalize your day and say, kids are out of the house. I have 6 hours to get stuff done. Go, go, go. And break it down. You have to break it down into a schedule, and you have to say, if I have to do 10 sketches in 6 hours, that means I have to do more than one sketch in an hour. I have to do a sketch and a half or a sketch and a quarter. Go. Like, you set these little goals for yourself. Your body will adjust to it. Like, if your body knows that you have to draw a sketch in an hour and a half, then you better be laser focused and not screw around and do that. But I think because of the many hats that I wear, I've actually developed this insane ability to multitask. And so I'll sit here and I'll work on a book, but then I'll also watch The Daily Show, and I'll answer emails, and I'll probably be instant messaging with someone at the same time. I'm doing all that at the same time. I'm not saying everybody should do that. I'm not saying everybody can do that. But I am saying that you can teach your body to deprive itself of sleep. You can teach your body to deprive itself of any, like of being able to do many things. But I guess if we're going to get personal here, I can't say that my father was someone who really knew how to do anything. You know, he always said, oh, I'm a traditionally old-fashioned Asian guy, you know? And that meant he mm-hmm. didn't know how to cook. He didn't know how to clean. He didn't know how to do anything, because that just wasn't the role that he had to fill. And that my mother, you know, my mother was always sick. She had lupus. She had breast cancer. And, you know, there were moments where my dad could have stepped up and he could have done these things, but he wasn't capable of doing them because he just didn't know how. And unfortunately, my mom had to go through that moment of, like, I have breast cancer, but you still need dinner, you know? And so I hate to say it, but I didn't want to be that man. You know, I wanted to be the guy that everyone in the family could say, don't worry, he's got it covered. You know, I didn't want to be the guy that just brought the paycheck home and then sat there and I just went into my man cave or whatever, you know, like. Again, I mean, I think it comes down to Beagle. It's the love letter. It's everything. It's, you know, I have a duty as a parent. And I also have an interest in my own personal career. But, you know, one life to live, you go at it 100%, you know? Yeah. And so, it was funny because last year I published 13 books last year, which to me was...
What?
It was ridiculous.
Crazy.
So, like, you know, typically for someone in the literary world, like, if you're doing 2 or 3 books a year, you're doing really well. And that was a year where I got this great opportunity to work on a series with Dave Pilkey, who's best known for Captain Underpants. And they said, well, he has this 9-book series and he would like you to illustrate it. He asked for you by name. And I, you know, like,
oh, shit.
That's not an opportunity that you pass up. Yes. You know, right?
Nope.
Yes, I am going to do that. But that project was thrown on top of an already full plate. And the unfortunate thing was that beginning of that year, both my parents got hospitalized for heart issues. And then my wife got hospitalized for appendicitis. And then I had these crazy deadlines just everywhere. And nobody would let up. No one would let up. They'd say, will you get those sketches in by this time? But contractually, you're obligated to do this. No one gave a shit. It was just like, you need to get this done. You owe this to us. And I remember I was at a point where I would just sit there and I would read an email and I would just break down and I would just cry. And it was because I remember there was a 7-day work week. And in that 7 days, I literally got 12 hours of sleep. And I worked so hard that I saw the face of death. Emotionally, I was drained. I was just depressed. I used to take great pride in saying, I can do 7 books a year. I can do 8 books a year. 13, way too much. Rethinking this whole career thing, I've actually taken it upon myself to take a step back, and I'm giving myself this year off. I still have contractual obligations to things that I've already signed up for, but what a lot of previous Caldecott medalists have told me is that this award gives you the power to say no. Mm. And so, I mean, I don't know. Part of me thinks that this award saved my life because living in Southern California, it's so ridiculously expensive, and paying for private school on top of that.
Oh,
And
wow.
there's healthcare, that things that you have to be mindful of. And of course, my wife would love to not have to work and she could be at home and spend time with the kids. 5 years ago, I was offered a position at Google as a doodle artist. And
Wow.
it was crazy. I got this call on the phone and, oh no, not, it wasn't a call. It was an email. The email said, "We've been watching you and we think you'd be a good fit for the doodle team. How would you like to come up for an interview?" And I thought this was really like, is this some kind of a joke? Is this a, am I being spammed here? And I remember taking the guy's name and Googling it, and it turned out he was Google HR. And I thought, okay, well, this is serious. I just want to go up there and I want to see if I can get the job. I don't necessarily want the job, but I want to see if I can say no to them. I want to know that I could get hired by them. So I flew up there. It was an 8-hour interview. And
Jeez.
like, if you've noticed, like the doodles now are much more, they're fancier now. Like they have animation, they have music. And
Yeah.
what they were hoping that I could do is, because I had experience in the video game industry, I had a cartoon show on the Disney Channel for a while, and I do publishing and I do gallery work. So I was this person that they were hoping to bring in, and I just have all these skills. I can do interactivity, I can do animation, and they wanted me to kind of be this creative director that could take their doodles to the next level, which you are seeing now. So they're obviously executing that part of the plan now. And there was a part where my wife, because my wife's from the Bay Area, she'd love to live closer to the family. And there was a point where we said, okay, if they offer me a job and they offer X amount of salary, then we will seriously consider it. And so Google sent me an offer and I looked at the envelope and I was thinking, okay, if it's this number, then we'll consider it. And Google went so far above what I was thinking.
Oh,
And
whoa.
then you get to this point in your life where you're thinking, and this was before my career was starting to get legs, and I knew that if I stuck with it, I would be okay. Or I could say, if I worked for Google, my wife wouldn't have to work. My kids would be an amazing school district, and I'd make enough money that they wouldn't have to worry about the cost of college. But I knew also that if they wanted to be in a good school district, I would have to stick with that job at Google up till they went off to college, would be, like a 13-year commitment. And so there were two sides of this. I thought, should I be the good financial parent that covers everyone's concerns financially and education-wise? Or should I pursue my dream of being a children's book author and also being able to spend time with the family, being here, cooking, doing the laundry, taking the soccer practice, those things. Like, there was the two parts of me that I was in this fork in the road. And I knew that the biggest regret that I had was, if I don't see how far I can go with this children's book career, I'm always going to regret not knowing how far I could have gone. And that was the reason why I didn't take that 9-to-5 job. And it was because I think there was just a part of me that had confidence that I could do it. And I think everybody starting out has to have a little bit of that optimism. Not a little bit, a lot. That's the thing that gets us through life, basically. You always hope that next year will be better than the one that you're in now, you
Yeah.
know? Even if it's not a huge improvement on the year before, you want life to get better every year.
So
And I
true.
remember getting that Google offer and turning them down, and Google was just like, "Whoa, what? Like, maybe this bigger bag of money will change your mind." And I remember I had to say to them, I said, "You need to just not call me anymore, because I think eventually there will be a price that can buy me, you know?" And so I still have the offer.
Oh,
Like, it's
wow.
above my computer in my little file drawer. And for all that time since saying no, I told myself, I never want to regret this moment. I never want to look back and say, I should have taken that job. I want to put myself in a position where I can say, I'm so glad that I chose the path that I did and that I didn't take Google. And now here I am 5 years later, you know?
Yeah. I mean, shit, Caldecott
Right, and
medal,
right.
come on,
But all
man.
that drive, all
Yeah.
that push to get to this point, I think
Yeah.
all that stemmed from my desire to not regret the job from Google. Wow. I think it's a huge part of it.
Damn, that is really admirable. You chose your passion. You stuck to what your heart wanted. And not a lot of people can say that. And you know what? I don't even know, honestly, what I would have done if I were in that situation.
Oh, right. I remember speaking to a lot of my peers, a lot of children's book author illustrators, like two or three of them. And I said, okay, let's say hypothetically that you were getting a job at Google and they were going to pay you X amount. And they were just like, wait a sec, how much did you say? And I was just like, X amount. And they said, yeah, I'd take the job. Like everyone across the board was like, yeah, no, I'd take the job. And I remember thinking, like, I want you to talk me off this ledge. Like deep inside, I think just having the conversation, I realized I want you to tell me to be true to my vision and not give out to the man. So I think I had already made my decision, but it was hard. It was hard. I remember like three weeks after saying no, I had to go give a keynote speech for SCBWI chapter in Washington. And so it was in front of like 500 people. And the keynote was really about pursuing your passion. And then at the last slide, you know, like at one of the last slides, I talked about turning down the job at Google. And then before I could finish the entire keynote, I just started crying on stage.
Oh, wow.
I started bawling. And then suddenly you just hear this clap, like, oh, God, you know. And I couldn't control myself. And yeah, I think for people who are creative, people who want to take the path least traveled, they want to hear those success stories. Everyone's in the same boat. Everyone wants to know that you can do it, that it's possible. Because if you're capable of doing it, then they think that there's hope for them. And that's what I mean, optimism. You have to believe that every year will get better than the next.
Yeah. Is there a YouTube video of your keynote speech?
Currently, there's no recording of that speech, but I will be giving the Caldecott acceptance speech in the end of June. And I know that they record that and put that on YouTube. And awesome. A lot of that speech covers a lot of what we've been talking about.
Oh, fantastic.
It talks about Google. It talks about self-doubt and everything. So that's going on there. And then I'm actually giving the commencement speech at UCSD.
Oh, wow.
In a couple weeks. And, you know, a lot of it is also going to be about pursuing your passion, you know, and saying, oh, well, I graduated here with a degree in microbiology, but I do nothing with that degree. And then everyone's like, what? You know, well, I went to art school and then I went on to do these other things. And I want you to realize that 80% of people don't do what their major was. And so you should not worry because you aren't par for the course if you're not doing what your major is. And really, I mean, I find that college isn't so much about preparing yourself for the job that you're going to have someday, but it's really preparing yourself to be an adult in the world.
Finding yourself.
Right. Because really, you know, up to a certain point in your life, when you're a kid, your whole goal is, I need to get to college. My parents want me to go to college. What are my goals? I have to do extracurricular activities and I have to get straight A's, but I have to do well on all these tests so that I can go to college. Okay, great. And then you get into college and they go, well, now that you got into college, what do you want to do with the rest of your life? And you're like 18 years old. You haven't explored the world. You know, you've basically been under the guidance of your family who said, well, maybe an engineer would be good. Maybe a doctor would be good. Maybe this or that would work out. But I think it's hard to decide what you want to be at the age of 18 if you haven't explored the world, like if you haven't understood things, you haven't lived life. And so a good part of the speech that I'm giving is, look, before you decide to be an adult and you realize that a good portion of your week is going to be spent in an office, just make sure that you want to be in that office because it's going to be for the rest of your life, you know? I've met so many people that work in science and it's like, oh, I got to go to work. And that's not a way to live. You shouldn't be working for the weekend. There's something great about saying that, oh, I do books every day and every day feels like I'm already retired. Like, I don't feel like I'm working. Because of that, I have no stress other than the stress of meeting deadlines.
That's pretty awesome. Man, I have like the biggest smile on my face right now. Like, you are the walking example of what I want my listeners to keep in mind when they're working hard towards their careers and not forget about what life is about, what makes us human,
right.
You know? So you are the
right.
example, the living, breathing role model of all of this. So thank you for that, Dan.
Oh, I think being open like this, being open and honest with yourself, I think that is probably, like, for anybody who is interested in the arts and creativity, I think being open and honest with yourself, like, that's the biggest part of it. If you can reveal everything about yourself, then you can write about anything. The last thing you want to do is censor yourself. If you can talk about everything, like, I'm doing a memoir about how I went from biology into art school and the relationship that I had with my parents and, you know, the breast cancer and all that. That's very personal stuff. And I'm not looking at it to make a dollar off of my life, but I feel like it's a story that is important to me that I want to share, because I think there's a lot of people that can relate to that moment of the day when you realize that your parents are not perfect. You know, I think there's a lot of beauty in that. You have to be creative, not because you want to be famous. There's far too many reality TV people out there. They just want to be on TV. They just want to be famous. You know, they want to be that girl that eats salad and gets 1,000 likes on Instagram. Like, that's all they live for. And it drives me nuts. You know, like, if you're going to be an actor, you have to be that actor that loves doing off-Broadway stuff. You just love being on stage and you love acting.
That's, yes, I agree 110%.
Right. That's the thing that you love to do. And if you're happy, then money doesn't matter. You're doing what you love. You don't need money because you're just going to be happy. You don't feel like you're working.
That is very true. Thank you so much for that, Dan. Well, I'm so excited for you for your commencement speech and also for making that speech at the Caldecott. What was that again? It was the Caldecott.
It's the Caldecott Banquet, the American Library Association Caldecott Banquet.
Oh, awesome. And then so you're going to be there making
a speech. And it's crazy because it's in San Francisco this year and it's like 30 miles from Google.
I mean, look, if that's not fate in your face saying, hey, great job choosing your heart over money, like, hello. Yeah.
It's been 5 years. It's crazy.
That's freaking crazy. That is a little bit too coincidental, let me tell
you.
But Dan, we'll wrap it up. And I know you've given us so much of your time and we're so grateful. I know you mentioned about the dummy book for people who want to write children's books or illustrate so that they're more aware. Do you have any other books you recommend that could help them further their careers?
Let me think. There are courses you can take. Like if you go to UCLA, there's a children's book writing course. Art Center College of Design has a children's book writing course. Books in particular, let's see. There's a children's book market. I'm forgetting the name. It's like the Children's Book Publishing and Market Guide, I think it's called. And you can buy it at any bookstore. And basically, it lists hundreds of publishers, the name of the art director and editors, the submission processes of getting your work seen. There's that one. I like David Ogilvy's book on running an ad agency.
Oh, okay, yes. Yes, I've heard
of that. That's a good one. I'm just looking at my bookshelves right now. I think really it comes down to a good chunk of it is knowing the business. And so go to a bookstore and just read hundreds of books. Find out what the industry is like right now. Find out if that's something you want to do. And then use modern day books as a template for how you should write. As great as classics are, like Where the Wild Things Are, it's great in a different level. But I don't necessarily know if someone would buy a Where the Wild Things Are in this day and age. You know what I'm saying?
Got it. Just keeping up with the times.
Right, right. Just knowing what's out there, knowing the rules to the game now. Yeah.
And can you let our audiences know before we head off where they can find you and say hi?
Oh, gosh. Let's see. I'm on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at dsantat, D-S-A-N-T-A-T. I'm on Facebook at Dan Santat. I have a Tumblr page. Well, I have a website. It's www.dantat.com, D-A-N-T-A-T.com. I frequent independent bookstores in Pasadena, California.
Dan, thank you again for an amazing interview.
Thank you for having me.
Hey guys, wow, did anyone else tear up during this episode? I got a bit choked up while I was editing this episode during the part where Dan talks about why he wants to be the kind of person his family can rely on. Really makes you take a step back and see that we're all responsible for our actions and how our choices affect those around us on a deeply personal level. A huge thank you to Dan for his time and for speaking with such honesty. I absolutely loved this chat with Dan. I actually interviewed him in the spring of this year, and I love the interview so much that I saved it as one of my super special ones. So you'll notice in the interview, we touch on the Caldecott Medal acceptance speech he was gearing up for in June. We're in November now, so the speech is available for you to check out. And to watch Dan's inspiring speech or to read a transcription of it, along with a list of resources he mentioned, be sure to head to his show notes page at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/DanSantat2. And that's the number 2. A ginormous thank you to you listeners for tuning in once again and joining me for my 25th episode. Please be sure to say hi to Dan on social media and let him know what you thought about his interview. And as always, I would love to hear your thoughts about this episode. Please reach out to me on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at 88 Cups of Tea. If you'd like to follow my adventures around Asia, check out hashtag 88 Cups of Asia. A heartfelt thank you to Scrivener for making this episode possible. I've honestly been having a bit of trouble keeping the ball rolling with a story that I want to write. A lot of times I make excuses to myself not being able to write for the day because I can't seem to find that great idea I jotted down for a chapter or the latest draft of that excerpt I wrote. Having Scrivener helps me a whole lot in getting rid of those excuses for myself. I'm honestly still having a bit of trouble committing fully to writing that story, but Scrivener makes things a lot easier for me when I'm feeling extra brave that day in tackling characters, ideas, and the story structure. I actually learned about Scrivener through one of my recent guests on the show. You may have heard her episode. It's the one featuring award-winning writer Jan Ellison of A Small Indiscretion. I've been using Scrivener for almost everything that involves writing ever since Jan raved about the software. Scrivener has truly helped make my life easier, and I'm excited to share this company with you. If you're a storyteller and haven't tried Scrivener out for yourself yet, you need to download their 30-day free trial. Give it a go. And if you end up loving it as much as I do, Scrivener is hooking us up with a special 20% off coupon code just for our Storyteller Tribe. And we have until the end of December 2015 before it expires. Head over to 88cupsoftea.com/Scrivener for the coupon code.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.